Hello and welcome to Superbugs in You, true stories from scientists and patients around the world. This podcast series explores the threat of antimicrobial resistance, which occurs when bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites change over time and no longer respond to antibiotics and other medicines. In other words, they become superbugs. I am Dr. Marnie Peterson, and I've spent the last 25 years focused on this topic, both as an educator and researcher, and I will be your host.
AMR is the greatest threat to my life. These infections are the greatest threat to my life, and I advocate for a day that it no longer will be the case.
Antimicrobials are the cornerstone of modern medicine. This is especially true for patients with cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis, also known as CF, is a progressive genetic condition that impacts multiple organ systems, most notably the lungs. People with CF rely on antibiotics for recurring and persistent infections. With regular use, antibiotics become less and less effective in fighting these infections. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, the most common culprit in CF infections, is especially notorious for its ability to adapt to and evade antibiotics. In this episode, we will speak with a patient advocate, clinician, and policy leader to better understand the unique challenges that superbugs pose for people battling cystic fibrosis.
My name is Ella Balassa, and I'm a patient advocate and patient engagement consultant. My mission is to empower patients living with various conditions to be more active in their healthcare and decision making, and also to inspire healthcare organizations to bring the patient voice and perspective into research and drug development, and ultimately creating therapeutics to improve people's lives. I'm also a person who has cystic fibrosis and has dealt with antimicrobial resistant infections throughout my life, and have now become an advocate in that space.
As you mentioned at the end, you have cystic fibrosis and were diagnosed with this disease. What is the disease? And tell us a little bit about when you were first diagnosed and how that impacted you.
So cystic fibrosis is a progressive genetic lung disease. And I was born with this condition and diagnosed at 18 months old. The hallmark of the disease is lung infections that are a result of the buildup of thick mucus in the lungs that the lungs of people with CF cannot clear on their own. And so this mucus in the lungs attracts bacteria from the air that we breathe in. And these infections over time, due to the cycle of these bacterial infections in the body's inflammatory system trying to fight the infections, this causes scar tissue and then lung damage and eventually respiratory failure and a shortened life expectancy. So over the course of my life, ever since I was very young, I have had to take lots and lots of antibiotics to try to clear these infections. And because of the way that the lungs of people with CF are, it's very habitable for these bacteria to reside in the lungs. So eradication of these infections is not possible for people with CF. And so that has required these continual courses of inhaled, oral, and oftentimes too intravenous courses of antibiotics. In addition to this, I daily have to do airway clearance treatments to try to remove as many of the lung secretions as possible to reduce that infection load. At this point, I have fairly low lung function due to the lung damage and disease that has occurred because of these infections. And I require the use of supplemental oxygen to help support me in, when I'm exercising and exerting a lot of physical activity because of my diminished lung capacity. And these lung infections over time have also become more and more difficult to treat due to the antibiotic resistance that has manifested in these microbes in my lungs. So at one point in 2019, actually, I had a very severe exacerbation. So this is a flare-up of the lung infection. And this resulted in me being completely resistant. The bacteria in my lungs were completely resistant to any antibiotics. This then led me down the path of receiving an experimental treatment for these infections, but I'll talk about that more.
So going back to where we left off is in 2019, you had this exacerbation and the diagnostics tests run on the microbes causing the infection and the resistance to all the antibiotics that are available to you. Very few of us would ever understand somebody telling them that, what that feels like. And this is the focus of this podcast, of preventing that happening to more people.
It was a very scary time. And I know that it's even hard to really describe. I guess I'll backtrack. Leading up to that point, I'd say for the few years prior to that, I had been dealing with this increase of pulmonary exacerbations requiring intravenous antibiotics for multiple weeks at a time. I was getting these infections pretty much every few months. I would clear an infection with a round of intravenous antibiotics. 2-3 months later, I would start to feel the symptoms again, where it's just increasing cough, increasing sputum production, shortness of breath, all of these symptoms associated with getting another infection. In 2019, when this really bad infection occurred, I was already used to it at that point. However, each one never gets easier. In fact, it's just more difficult because my lung capacity was increasingly more diminished. To put it into perspective, I was short of breath even to take a shower. Putting my hands over my head to wash my hair was exerting so much effort that I couldn't breathe very well, and I was using oxygen for that. And there was no relief in my symptoms, even once I started the intravenous antibiotic regimen for that infection. And I was using intravenous, like meropenem, and I was using colistin as well, which is one of the strongest antibiotics that we have in our arsenal today. And I knew leading up to that, that my life could not be sustained with the frequency of antibiotics that I was using. It was just very scary to come to the realization that I was fighting this battle that was raging inside my body that I could not do anything about. It's really a terrifying experience where I didn't know what the future would hold. I had no idea.
I assume you were part of your own solutions when you got to that point. And that brings me to wanting to have a discussion with you as the patient with cystic fibrosis and then somebody that was also very interested in biology and science. So tell us about your scientific journey a little bit.
Yeah, so I graduated with a degree in biology and then worked in a microbiology lab after graduating. This was obviously my early 20s, and that was really what prompted my interest in advocacy and then what led to me finding treatments and solution for this infection as well. But in the lab, we're actually looking at environmental microbes found very commonly in our environment that are also common infections found in the lungs of people with CF. And we were looking at antibiotic resistance in environmental samples. And so this experience and thinking about my own personal journey dealing with infections and the healthcare system, having synergy with the work that I was doing in the laboratory, and then realizing that I have this patient voice and perspective with this background that I felt that I could really add value to bridging these gaps between the patient community, the research community, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole. And so that's what prompted me to start initially volunteering with a lot of research groups as part of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation as well. And I'm actually still part of it. The CF Foundation has the Infection Research Initiative. So this was really a group comprised of researchers in CF, some individual in the foundation as well, and the patient voice coming together to strategize what remains the needs of the CF community when it comes to treating and successfully eliminating infections in CF. So it's these kind of opportunities that I really found my voice as a patient where I felt that I could contribute value and really have an impact in bringing new novel therapeutics for the treatment of AMR, antimicrobial resistant infections for the CF community, but then also realize my voice more broadly as just one person that has dealt with antimicrobial resistant infections that is really advocating in the CF space, but then also more broadly branching out in how, you know, AMR really affects our global population and the need that there is in attention to this issue and how that can, how it will grow to affect many people outside of those that just chronically or consistently use antibiotics.
Going back to being told we have no more antibiotics that could treat this infection that you have, and you have this experience now, or you've been a scientist, you've been in a laboratory, tell the listeners what solutions you were able to find for yourself.
So yeah, returning back to that particularly bad infection that I had in 2018, at that point, I had also been already sharing my patient journey, living with chronic disease, living with CF, on some blog platforms and contributing to giving input in within the clinical trial space too. So I had a couple of various articles published in journals and things like that. And so I actually had gotten reached out to about a treatment that was being done for a patient in Texas against resistant infections. And this was called phage therapy. And so I had heard about phage therapy being someone that is up to date and interested in the research that's going on in the CF space, but I did not know much about it. And so they had asked me to compose a piece to go along with this documentary talking about what life with CF is like. And so when I reviewed this piece, this documentary, and realized that this patient was being treated with something novel that could be effective against antimicrobial resistant infections, I immediately reached out to researchers at Yale University who were conducting this research and explained my situation, that I'm a patient who has dealt with these infections and increasingly impacting my life. And they were fairly receptive to potentially treating me with phage as well. So long story short, I sent them sputum samples, the selected phage that would be appropriate in treating the infection. And then I made the decision on my own accord to get treated with phage, being that it is an experimental therapy and not an approved FDA therapeutic. To explain to the listeners exactly what phage is, phages are viruses, actually, that target a called bacteriophage, and they target a very specific bacterial host. I had Pseudomonas aeruginosa going in my lungs, and so phage target, as I said, a very specific strain of bacteria, and they're not like antibiotics where they are broad spectrum or target a range of different bacteria. And so using this virus, it attaches to a bacterial cell, inserts its DNA, that bacteria replicates the DNA, and then it kills that bacteria cell, it bursts, and then the new phage go out and proliferate other bacteria. And I learned, again, having like my background in biology, I really did a lot of the research myself and really felt comfortable with what my knowledge of what this treatment could be and what the possibility of it, and understanding the risk as well. And so made the decision to get this treatment through FDA expanded access, so for an experimental treatment. And it was effective in clearing that very difficult infection that I was dealing with at that time. So that was the story of how I then really became this AMR advocate. That was the experience that made me realize, one, how serious these infections really were to my life, how I don't want other patients to experience this as well. And then I wanted to bring awareness to novel therapeutics that potentially can treat these type of infections, because bacteria have an uncanny ability to develop resistance to any antibiotics that are thrown at them. And so we really see the need and the value in creating novel types of therapeutic options. Especially after I received that phage therapy and my story really went, you could say, somewhat viral, and really, at least within the CF community, I had a lot of people reaching out to me asking, how can they be treated for their resistant infections? And that just reaching out to me for help. And so I've connected with a lot of people in that regard. I say that AMR is the greatest threat to my life. These infections are the greatest threat to my life. And I advocate for a day that it no longer will be the case.
So we've covered how important antibiotics and phage therapy have been in fighting these recurrent lung infections. Can you tell us a bit more about other therapies used in treating cystic fibrosis and how they impact AMR?
As a whole, CF is getting, there are new treatments. In 2019, I had that really bad infection. I received the phage therapy for it, which was successful. And then later that year, I got access to a new drug that is for treating the underlying cause of CF, and that's called Trikafta. And since the approval of that drug, that has, as a whole, really impacted positively the CF community in that it is addressing the underlying cause of the disease. That basically means that there is less infection that is being harbored in the lungs because of there's less of this mucus accumulation. So because the body isn't producing as much mucus for the bacteria to thrive in, so therefore the bacteria colonies have reduced as a whole. And so this means that people are not having as many recurrent lung infections. I think as a whole, the dependence on antibiotics has to some degree lessened. For example, I've only used intravenous antibiotics one time since starting that treatment in 2018. Whereas before that, as I said, it was multiple times every year and increasingly worse. And that is something that I've been very fortunate to have. And many in the CF community, of course, have benefited from it. However, I still use oral and inhaled antibiotics every few months. Before, those methods were not as effective in eradicating the infections because just like the sheer amount of bacteria that were growing in the lungs could not be treated effectively enough with these inhaled and oral options. And so that's why I would have to do intravenous antibiotics for multiple weeks at a time. But that being said, I still use inhaled and oral antibiotics every couple of months. So it's not like it's completely eliminated the problem. And that is also why I am just as strong of an advocate now as I was then.
Describing your current work, where you're putting the focus on research needed, specific areas of development for new antimicrobials, what is some of that work? What are some of the areas that you're focused on?
Primarily, I serve as a voice for other patients who have dealt with AMR and who will deal with AMR infections in the future. So I feel like at this point, I have developed this platform by which, you know, and by which I can bring this awareness to this growing problem. So I would say that is the primary way by which I feel I can and am making an impact. But, you know, as well as in serving as network for companies that are especially like starting out in this space. So within the phage therapy community, I've definitely become very embedded. I speak at a number of conferences and have connected with a number of companies that are working to develop phage therapies, coming into clinical trials, and many researchers too, connected all over the world. Outside of that too, I've been a part of a number of documentaries that feature my story and really, I feel, have a really broad reach and have that ability to make an impact on a broader community to really humanize what this patient experience is for those that have dealt with AMR and really the devastation and the fear and really potentially fatal outcomes that can occur because of it.
Let's talk about policy, because to do the research, you need support a lot of times in this space of even public-private partnerships. So you need to have that policy piece. So yes, please tell us a little bit about that. And then something that I picked up on in your introduction is how you are continuing to expand and take even more, a more global perspective of how we're all connected.
Yeah, so I've been in support together with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation because they're a strong advocacy organization in the policy space as well, but really in support of the Pasteur Act, which is hopefully a policy that would incentivize the development of new antibiotics because of market exclusivity and a certain payment amount that would be given to any company that is developing a new antibiotic, because there really is not many novel antibiotics that are in development or will be in the future because of the problem that it is for targeted for a very relatively small population that would be taking the drug. in addition to really the broad need of antimicrobial stewardship, which is not overusing antibiotics when you don't need them, I've recently been selected to be on the World Health Organization's AMR Task Force of Survivors. And so it's really a global initiative that is bringing together patient voices from people all over the world who have dealt with AMR infections due to various conditions and problems, some being skin infections, some being from tuberculosis, some being from various surgical site infections. All of us are very strong advocates within our own regions. And so this initiative to bring together these voices and really, you know, highlight, humanize the patient experience to then inspire hopeful collaboration between various stakeholders, whether that including the policy leadership focus, the focus on including the researchers themselves and inspiring them to develop novel ways of attacking bacteria. And then also in this private-public partnership sort of space as well, where it's nonprofits and investors and funders coming together to put money towards potential new treatments against AMR infections. There's also, as part of this initiative, there's also a focus on really establishing national action plans for how AMR will be tackled from a government standpoint. And also within some of the regional offices of the WHO to really have a more of a grassroots effort from the bottom up, where we start from educating the public, and then the more people that understand, the more that we can get momentum behind the problem that it is. And the more people that understand, the more people that we're going to want to change this problem. And really that awareness to knowing that there are increasingly more and more people that will be affected by AMR is really the focus of a lot of this effort.
There's probably some patients listening and caregivers of patients, and if they want to increase their engagement and their advocacy, what kind of advice do you give them?
You know, I think we're all so very connected on social media nowadays, when it's such a great tool to share news rapidly around the world. And I think it can also be utilized within this for this purpose as well. I think it starts with just having that inspiration to want to make a change or want to elicit change in the experiences of people in the future. And that means sharing the story of a loved one that has dealt with an AMR infection within your own social circles and spheres, on your social media platforms. I think it really starts small. And then once you gain more footing and more connections, then that voice can be amplified. I've also been a part of a number of local news channel kind of stories as well. For those that have personally dealt with it, it is very difficult to share. And one might not think that their experience can help other people who might be going through it, or just to, again, bring this greater awareness. But in fact, it's very important, because together our voices do elicit change and improve greater innovation. I also think that it's so important to ground the problem in a relatable context. A lot of people think, oh yeah, AMR might affect this person that has CF and uses antibiotics all the time, or, oh, this person that had tuberculosis, that's not something that I'll ever have to deal with. But really how common skin infections can be, or when within the hospital setting too, getting an infection at a surgical site, it really can happen more often than one thinks. And so I think making AMR more relatable to the everyday average person, making sure that they understand the reality of what it can be. And so I think that's an area where I see one of the broadest impacts and how we can really help to educate the public and help them understand.
I'm Helen Boucher, and I currently serve as the Dean of Tufts University School of Medicine and the Chief Academic Officer of Tufts Medicine, and I'm a practicing infectious disease physician.
I want to focus on our topic today, which is cystic fibrosis. And so let's talk about bacterial pathogens and how they play a role in these patients and some of your concerns that you've had during your career as a physician.
So cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease that's inherited generation by generation, and it used to be universally fatal. And children who had it, sadly, their parents knew that they weren't going to live a full life. And miraculously, I think, with the advances of science, we now have medicines that address the problem, the genetic problem that causes this enzyme deficiency that leads to cystic fibrosis. So that's great. However, the patients who have cystic fibrosis still succumb to infection. And infection is the number one cause of death in cystic fibrosis. And the types of infections that these patients get are in their lungs or in their gut. And it's the lung infections that typically are the most life-threatening. What happens with cystic fibrosis is that there's a difficulty in clearing the lung and the mechanisms of keeping infection out of the lung, and mucus builds up. And it creates a perfect environment to grow bacteria. There are this like sliminess in the lung biofilms that allow bacteria to grow, common bacteria like staph that lives on many people's skin, but also really other kinds of bacteria not so common like Pseudomonas. And in this environment, over time, patients can get infected with one bug or multiple bugs, and these can become extremely difficult to treat and to eradicate, to make gone. And when patients have damage to their lungs, they might need a lung transplant. And if they have an infection that we can't control, they can't get their lung transplant. So infection is just a dreaded complication of this disease in multiple ways. So we want to do everything we can to prevent the infections, right? So we want to treat the disease as early as possible in people who have it so they never get to that place where their lungs are damaged and they have recurrent infection. And then we want to treat infections early and completely if we can in this population.
Can you speak a little bit about the magnitude of antibiotic resistance in the CF population, maybe even recalling some of your experiences of caring for individuals and getting reports back from the laboratory of these bacteria are present in their lung. This is the options that you have.
Once infection sets up shop in somebody with cystic fibrosis in their lungs, the more common scenario is that you can't get rid of it. You try to keep it under control. So these patients typically have exacerbations that might happen once a year or twice a year, and then they can get more and more frequent. And as that happens, you treat typically with antibiotics during that exacerbation. And there's this kind of push and pull between wanting to prevent and treat the exacerbation and not overtreat with antibiotics to breed antibiotic resistance, right? And you can imagine that every time bacteria are faced with antibiotic pressure, we call it, that's how they become resistant. They become resistant in nature, but when we expose patients to antibiotics, they become resistant faster. So in patients with cystic fibrosis, we see, sadly, patients who develop these flares more and more often, they get more antibiotics, the bacteria become more resistant, and then we start running into difficulty where we get back reports that one or more of the bacteria growing from their lungs are resistant to the antibiotics we have available. So typically, first, they're resistant to the oral antibiotics, to the pills. Then they become resistant to the stronger antibiotics that are only available through an IV. And when that happens, we get into trouble. The patient gets into trouble. And that's how we lose patients, sadly. We see patients for whom something like a transplant is no longer an option. And then we see patients where there is no antibiotic option. And we do things like look for investigational agents. And then sadly, there are patients where we don't have anything to offer. And so when I started in infectious diseases over 30 years ago now, I never heard of a patient where we didn't have anything to offer. And in the last 10 years, I've had the sad duty of having to send patients home on hospice because we couldn't treat their infection. And that is not something anybody in infectious diseases ever wants to do, right? In fact, bacterial infections are curable. Like, we go into this business because we cure people. And so to not be able to offer that is heartbreaking. And then you look at a disease like cystic fibrosis, where we now have a treatment for the underlying problem. It's even more heartbreaking because you can fix what's broken with the disease, but we can't fix the infection.
Part of our conversation talks about stewardship and antibiotic stewardship. How do you balance that with these patients when you're trying to reserve antibiotics at the same time you're trying to prevent infections? Are there other strategies you take? You talked about trying to support the disease state itself and some of the new advancements there.
The most important thing is to do everything we can to prevent the infection in the first place. So it's things like treating the disease as early and well as possible, vaccinating for as many things as we can vaccinate for. And that's something we don't tend to talk about enough, but Streptococcus pneumoniae, which causes pneumonia, we have a vaccine for that. And people with cystic fibrosis should be vaccinated. And so thinking about flu, thinking about other things that put people at increased risk of bacterial infection, making sure we do that, we vaccinate. Making sure nutrition is addressed. People with cystic fibrosis, this disease affects the gut, and many persons with cystic fibrosis have nutrition problems. And being undernourished increases your risk of infection and increases your risk of doing poorly with infection. So thinking about nutrition is very important. Thinking about staying healthy in other ways like exercise and those types of things are also important. But then to come back to your question about stewardship, it's limiting antibiotic use as much as possible so that they're available to be the life-saving tools that we need when we need them. That is very difficult in this disease. And we talked about this exacerbation phenomenon. People with cystic fibrosis who have active disease, they're usually coughing all the time. They have some sputum production. So figuring out the difference between kind of what's the usual level of cough and sputum production to an exacerbation, that's a specialty. And there's a special kind of doctor who does this for a living. And the best we have, I think, in 2023 is using those tools, those assessment tools, to decide when it's bad enough to need antibiotics, because we want to intervene before a patient is sick enough to need to come to the hospital, loses weight, gets into other kinds of problems. It's part of the art of medicine as well. The other thing that's important from a stewardship perspective is treating with narrow spectrum therapy as much as possible, right? So figuring out what we're treating, if there's one pathogen like Staph aureus, for example, then trying to only treat with a narrow antibiotic that just treats the staph so that we don't develop resistance more broadly. Those are the principles that we use in stewardship.
Yeah, and it ties in with your research. In addition to being dean and leader of the center that we're going to talk about next, the Stuart Levy Center for Integrative Management of Antimicrobial Resistance, you were a researcher as well as a clinician focusing on Staph aureus infections in immunocompromised patients. What is it about that pathogen that you think allows it to be so problematic in CF? And did you often see resistance in that organism when the patients were being cared for?
Yeah, so staph is a really bad pathogen, right? It's a common pathogen. 40% of people are colonized with staph on their skin. And for reasons we still don't totally understand, some people get infected with it. And of those, some of it is resistant, or MRSA, resistant to the first line antibiotics. It's really bad in that when it can get into the bloodstream. And when it does, up to 25% of people die. And that's 25% of all people, you, me, somebody with cystic fibrosis. Despite all of our efforts to study it and to understand, there's still so many questions. And I was just at a meeting earlier today talking about treating this staph in the blood. It's a very vexing infection. It's the most common disease treated by infectious disease doctors in America. And rightfully, it's bad. And it's one infection where we know that having an infectious disease doctor makes a difference in the outcome for the patient. So I find it fascinating still to this day, and I've had the privilege to work on some antibiotics that treat staph over the years. In cystic fibrosis, it's important because it gets in the lung and it does a lot of damage, right? Staph has the ability to cut through tissue. So it's in the sputum, but it also can cut right into the lung tissue. It can cut through to the pleural space, the lining of the lungs, and get into the bloodstream and cause a lot of havoc. So it's not something we want to see. And certainly when it's MRSA, it's even harder to treat. And the drugs we have their limitations and they have toxicities. And for patients with cystic fibrosis who might need antibiotics often and in longer durations, those toxicities can really add up. And so for MRSA, for example, despite the fact that it's not a great drug, the number one drug is vancomycin, which goes in through a vein. It can be phlebitic to the vein, but it can cause toxicity to hearing and to the nerves and make your balance over time. So for persons with cystic fibrosis, if you need that drug repeatedly over time, like, we worry about those toxicities. And that's not good for an otherwise young person who's living their full life.
I want to bring up the importance of biofilms here. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with biofilms, They are a group of microorganisms that form a sticky mat on the surfaces of tissues or medical devices, and they can be incredibly difficult to treat. So how do biofilms play a role in patients with cystic fibrosis?
So we know that staff loves biofilms and forms biofilms, and you know that environment for cystic fibrosis is very friendly. And we also know that other pathogens can get in that space, and you can have what we would consider almost synergistic infections. The interaction of those pathogens, the best way to treat multi-pathogen infections, those are still things we don't understand that well. We do the best we can. We use combinations of drugs and other modalities. But that's an area, again, I think where research is really needed, is to understand. Obviously, prevention is the best thing, to never get there. But when a patient is faced with that, understanding what the best treatment is something that we still have a lot of work to do on.
We've spoken quite a bit about therapies and stewardship. What are some of the other areas we should be focusing on to address AMR?
Infection prevention in general, right? That's everything from hand hygiene to making sure that procedures are done in the safest way and that people are paying attention to that in hospitals. That's very important. That's an important part of the response to the problem of antibiotic resistance. Along with that goes surveillance, which we didn't talk about, but we live in a country still today. We don't know enough about the resistance that is among us. We don't have a map of our country where you can drop down anywhere and know what the MRSA rate is or what the Pseudomonas resistance rate is, right? In Europe, they do. In America, we don't. So we have more work to do in terms of surveillance. We don't have a single system, right? So we don't have a national health system. We don't have a way that we're all connected, so that you could argue my hospital, I have data and I can get down to the different ICUs of what the different resistance patterns are. But down the street from my hospital is a Harvard hospital. We don't share the data, right? So because we're separate entities, that's part of the problem. The CDC doesn't have, they'll say they don't have a budget that allows them to do surveillance across the country. So I think there's many layers to the reasons, yeah. But a lot of it has to do with not having a national health system and a way to execute. And then the last thing, that just because it's what I do, is drug development. We need more antibiotics, and we need all kinds, right? We need antibiotics for drug-resistant staph and Pseudomonas and IV, but we also need pills. We have patients, healthy young women like yourself, who get a urinary tract infection and there's no pill, so we have to give them IV. It's terrible. It's not even just ease of use, it's safety, right? Every time there's an IV, there's a risk of a life-threatening infection.
I want to switch gears to your leadership at the Stuart Levy Center for Integrative Management of Antimicrobial Resistance. Talking a little bit about the purpose and some of the core focus areas you're working on. And then just add in a little bit about Dr. Stuart Levy and what he meant to AMR as well, for those that don't know.
Sure. So the CMAR, as we call it, the Levy CMAR is our center, is a joint center between Tufts University and Tufts Medicine to address the problem of antimicrobial resistance from a One Health perspective, right? We know that antimicrobial resistance is a problem of humans, animals, and the environment, and that antibacterial resistance moves back and forth. And we focus on several approaches to combating antimicrobial resistance. So one is antimicrobial stewardship. We started our stewardship program at Tufts in 2002, and we have a very sophisticated stewardship program. We focus on treatment, and in particular, combination drug treatment. So for infections like the ones we were discussing, sometimes using a combination is needed because of the resistance, for example, for Pseudomonas. We have investigators who have developed tools that allow the study of multiple combinations of drugs at one time from a sample from a patient. So trying to understand how best to use the tools of the drugs that we have available to us in a better way through combination. And then through advocacy and education is our other big focus. In 2024 now, it's still true that I think the biggest problem about antimicrobial resistance is awareness. In our country, not enough people know about this problem. Not enough citizens know that we're living in a world where there are infections for which we have no antibiotics to treat them. Not enough people know that we don't have enough antibiotics in the pipeline. And so we have spent efforts on building awareness and on education. So we educate down to the elementary school level, but certainly in the high school and undergraduate level. So we have programs with some inner city high schools where we do things like poster days where they focus on antimicrobial resistance. We run a mini med school program in the summer where students come to Tufts and they have a med school experience and they focus on antimicrobial resistance. And we have a number of other advocacy areas. And I've spent a lot of my career over the last 15, maybe 20 years working on advocacy. And I had the privilege of serving on the Presidential Advisory Committee for Combating Antibacterial Resistance. In that work, tried to work with all the groups in the government to better advocate for developing solutions, diagnostics, treatments, vaccines, and awareness and prevention for this problem. So the Levy Center is deeply embedded in this work, over 50 faculty from across the university and the health system and colleagues outside the health system as well, working to combat the problem. The name after Stuart Levy, Stuart was a professor at Tufts who was a real pioneer in antimicrobial resistance. Back in the 1970s, he did one of the first studies looking at feeding chickens antibiotics for growth promotion and how that led to resistance. And he showed that feeding chickens antibiotics made them fatter, but it also bred resistance. And he published that work in the New England Journal. So it was an early report of animal to human transmit, you know, the whole thing, and got a lot of negative feedback for it. But he was prescient and he really foretold what was coming. And so we are very much trying to live out his legacy and combat the problem of antimicrobial resistance.
Also with the center, quite multidisciplinary.
Yes.
So could you speak a little bit about that? Like, it's taking this one held approach. It's called integrated management of antimicrobial resistance. So what is that interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary group that you've put together?
Yeah, so it's really important, right? So it's the things you would think about, right? It's PhD scientists, MDs, pharmacists, right? Antimicrobial stewardship includes pharmacists as well as microbiologists from the medical microbiology lab. It includes educators, real experts in education and how we educate at every level about this problem. Social scientists. So it turns out that like getting people to change their behavior, to change their behavior about things like using antibiotics and putting antibiotics in their food, there's a science to that. And so having those scientists at the table thinking about how we develop studies and how we implement, implementation science, very important. Patient advocates. So having patients at the table for as much of the work that we do as possible is really important. We have veterinarians. We do work, not just in, you'd think about food animals, but we do work with companion animals like dogs and cats. It turns out that many tons of antibiotics are administered to companion animals in our country. And it's not really well understood how resistance works in that setting. Environmental scientists, just like we study COVID in the wastewater, we study antibacterial resistance in the wastewater as a measure of what's going on. So those are just some of the groups that participate in the center, but very much interdisciplinary. And just like the approach in our country is across everything from the CDC and the NIH and the FDA to the Department of Defense to the Department of Education, right? It's all across really the citizenship.
I'm Mary Dwight. I'm the Chief Policy and Advocacy Officer at the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the foundation for people that aren't familiar.
So the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is leading the way in the fight against cystic fibrosis and the search for a cure. We fund research and drug development. We work to advance high-quality specialized care for cystic fibrosis. And we partner deeply with people with cystic fibrosis and their families and supporters. We fund more CF research than any organization, and nearly every drug for cystic fibrosis available today was made possible through support from the foundation. It's been a remarkable trajectory for the organization. When it was established in the 1950s, it was established by parents who had children who didn't live to see kindergarten. And today, the median predicted survival for somebody born with cystic fibrosis is 56. So it's a remarkable change in a devastating disease to be now one of hope and promise. Certainly, a median age of 56 is nowhere close to what we want, and we're still working very hard again to find better treatments and ultimately a cure for cystic fibrosis.
Let's talk about your roles in the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation when you first came and how things have changed for you within the foundation as policies, what's become important, advocacy, working with patient advocates, some of those things.
A lot of that change has been of age and living longer with CF has been part of my journey with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. We've added more than 20 years of life expectancy since I joined the organization a little more than 17 years ago. So pretty remarkable to see that trajectory, more than a year of life for every year I've worked there. It's extremely wonderful. And again, we're very much not done. When I walked in the door, my main job as the head of the policy and advocacy arm of the organization was driving research. And it was a very singular focus on cystic fibrosis research. And what's been remarkable to watch and to be a part of is as that research was successful, what we needed to focus on expanded. And thinking about care in particular, what kind of care people with cystic fibrosis needed, what we were focused on, and I know we're going to talk about infection throughout this podcast, that's been something that's been persistent, even as CF care has improved and people are living longer. We still have some bedrock problems that emerge in cystic fibrosis that we haven't cracked yet.
I'd like to talk about some of the other issues before we get into that. Someone's living till 50 plus years old. They need a lot of health care. What's the sustainability of their life, of the cost of care? What are some of the other priorities that you're focused on besides infection?
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's how do we really enable somebody with cystic fibrosis to not only be somebody with cystic fibrosis? Yeah. How do we enable them and help them live their best life so that CF doesn't dominate their life? And I think that's what you're starting to see with the emergence of really amazing new treatments that treat the symptoms of cystic fibrosis more effectively, but also treat the genetic defect itself on a daily basis. It enables people to think beyond CF. And what's really wonderful and exciting is to see what that looks like across the spectrum of the patient population. We're seeing people, first and foremost, most importantly, live longer. But what does that look like? It means they're going to school, they're graduating from college, they're finding careers, they're getting married, they're having children. And that is really the heart of the goal, right? Living your best life. Living beyond just somebody with cystic fibrosis, being a full, whole person who has CF. And I think you see a lot of challenges as that story unfolds in terms of, yes, affordability and making sure that you always have the best possible care. We still absolutely need somebody with CF to have access to highly specialized rare disease care, orphan disease care at a unique setting. It's not just down at the Minute Clinic, right? So that bedrock importance of access to high quality healthcare, coverage for it, adequate coverage for it that's affordable, has been a real principle of the CF Foundation and a lot of our work in the policy space to protect that so that people can go on and live their best lives and continue to benefit from all the new treatments that are out there today and we hope will be forthcoming.
You mentioned orphan disease status. Makes me think that it would be good for you to describe approximately how many individuals in the United States are living with this disease.
Well, that number is growing too. And right now, a little more than 40,000 people have cystic fibrosis in the United States. An orphan disease is officially described as anything under 200,000 people. So very much in that rare disease category.
So turning the focus back to issues related to antimicrobial resistance, what are some of the priorities as it pertains to the foundation and some of the issues you're trying to address and solutions that you're trying to develop?
Issues of difficult to treat infections are a hallmark of cystic fibrosis. Even at very young ages, more than 60% of people with CF test positive for at least one bacteria that could make them sick. And this rate increases to more than 80% as people get older. And it really is a consistent and perennial threat in cystic fibrosis, the issue of multidrug resistance. Again, with these chronic infections, each time somebody gets one and utilizes the antibiotics that they need to treat them, the risk of resistance grows. So we're a rare disease, as we just discussed, but in the case of antibiotic resistance, I think people with CF today are facing challenges that are what a lot of other people are worried the larger population will face tomorrow if we don't act now to combat and effectively address antimicrobial resistance. So the CF community certainly has a very vested interest in addressing these concerns, given the prevalence of infection in the CF population. And so the CF Foundation utilizes that need to drive our mission, our goals, and aggressively invest in research to accelerate the development of new antibiotics, new anti-infectives, and supporting policies that address some of the failures that we see in the current development ecosystem that don't enable these really important drugs to come to market and to stay on the market.
You certainly are at the table with some other pillars that are stakeholders, organizations in the United States that are focused on AMR and infectious diseases. Can you just tell me a couple of those stakeholders? And specifically, I'm talking about, we're going to get into the Pasteur Act and the work there and how you're doing that along with these other stakeholders.
There are two answers there, two categories of answers. Yeah. So let me start with the science. The foundation, as I said, is deeply committed to doing our part to address unmet medical needs to fight infection. And that means funding research to provide more antibiotics and anti-infectives out there in the arsenal against these bugs, and also to continue to address the issue of antibiotic resistance. So there on the science front, we really try to put our money where our mouth is. We are one of the largest funders in the world of antibiotic drug development. In 2018, we dedicated $100 million over 5 years to our infection research initiative to accelerate the development of novel antibiotics and anti-infectives. And we've seen significant growth in the drug development pipeline as a result. And to your point, I think importantly, certainly our focus is developing drugs that combat bugs that are prevalent in the CF community. But what we see in the data is that many of those bugs that are highly prevalent in the CF community and that we want to fight are also increasingly prevalent in the general population. So as we drive research into CF, it is going to have a ripple effect to develop antibiotics that will hopefully benefit many people well beyond CF. So I said we committed $100 million over 5 years in 2018. I'm proud to say that we've far surpassed that goal. And we've funded more than $143 million in the last 5 years for this infection research initiative. And again, its goal is to address chronic and intractable infections that are that hallmark of CF. The proof isn't just the money spent. Obviously, that's helpful. But the proof is that we've invested in more than 250 research and academic projects and more than 20 industry programs. And we're seeing those make their way through the drug development pipeline into clinical trials and hopefully into patients. So that's a place where you're talking about stakeholders. So there are stakeholders, our researchers, biotech companies, usually these are in smaller companies like biotech, not big pharma. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And obviously, most importantly, the patients who are participating in clinical research to drive these therapies forward. Yes. So that's of critical importance. But let's talk about another piece of the puzzle for antibiotic development. In order to do this, I think it's important to think about the way we actually use antibiotics, particularly outside of cystic fibrosis. So we're, again, we're a bit of an outlier in CF because in cystic fibrosis, as I said before, people with CF have chronic infections. And I mentioned almost 60% of young children are routinely culturing bugs that need to be treated with antibiotics. So it's very common for somebody with cystic fibrosis to be on chronic antibiotic therapy to treat and combat these bugs and keep them at bay. That's unusual. And most of us, if you think about antibiotics, you think about for yourself or your child, you have some bug that's cropped up and you're going to go to the doctor and you're going to get amoxicillin for a handful of days and then you're done with it and you've moved on. And so that is really the typical way that antibiotics are used, very acutely, very briefly. And most of the antibiotics out there that we use all the time have been around for decades. And so most of them are generic and they cost very little to make and they cost very little to purchase. And so that is a nice thing for those of us who use them all the time, but it's not a great thing for incentivizing the development of new antibiotics because the market is such that, again, low volume, low pricing. And so there's not a lot of incentive to drive the use of, and development of new antibiotics. And the other thing that we see in antibiotic market is because we are much more attuned to the problem of resistance of antibiotics, we want to use the old existing therapies first. We don't want to use and show those bugs the new stuff we have, the sort of new big arms, because that will, every time you use an antibiotic, increases the possibility that bug will become resistant to it. So you want to use the old stuff first, which again does not incentivize the development of new. If the goal of developing a new antibiotic is to put it behind the don't use only in emergency, break glass in case of emergency, to hold it back and have it sit on the shelf, not a lot of incentive financially to develop that new drug where the purpose of it is to have it not be used. There we become interested in how do we disrupt this dysfunctional marketplace for antibiotics. And that's where policy comes in. How did we develop something new to make it interesting and intriguing for companies to come into the antibiotic space and develop the new antibiotics that we need to be able to effectively combat these resistant bugs? And so the policy solution that has been landed on is something called a subscription model. That's basically the concept there. Think of it like Netflix for antibiotics, where we want to pay drug companies upfront for effective new antibiotics to ensure they're available, even if we don't use them very much. So we're paying to have them out there, no matter how often they are used. It's a guaranteed market for new antibiotics. And that is a policy that is manifested in a piece of legislation called the PASTEUR Act, which is a bipartisan, bicameral piece of legislation that is supported, again, to your point on stakeholders, by a variety of stakeholders, including patients like us in the CF community, providers, particularly infectious disease docs who see these antibiotic resistant bugs all the time, research organizations, drug companies and manufacturers, and several others who are all that have vested interests in making sure that we have effective antibiotics. There's the little high-level overview of the policy prong of how we're going to find more antibiotics out there.
One of the very important voices and impactful voices, as you mentioned before, patients. And within this episode, we interviewed Ella Balassa, and she's a very strong advocate.
She's an amazing advocate.
Yeah. And tell us about your work with patients and maybe with Ella, but others, and how important they are to, they're the voice. They can be the strongest voice.
The foundation was established by patients and their families. They are at the heart of everything we do. They drive our mission and our goals. We strive to amplify and enable their voices throughout, especially in the issues of policy, throughout the political debate. And our job is really, again, to elevate and amplify their needs and their voices, their stories, raising the issue of antibiotics and resistance and putting a face on it. And I think that's something that's really important, especially in this era of politics that can be very frustrating, right? It's hard. You hear people say, I don't think Washington cares about me. Well, they need to hear why, and they need to put a face on issues because it does make it more real. I think when you understand that this sort of theoretical thing is actually happening to people, it does make it resonate a bit more. And so people like Ella and many others in the CF community who are willing and brave enough to share their experiences with policymakers really does make a difference. And we see it resonating more in the halls of Congress. It is far different to have, as important as they are, an academic researcher or a member of a biotech company sitting across and talking to you about the issue of infection resistance versus a person who's experienced it and sat in the hospital or lives with routine home IV use to deliver their antibiotic, the last one that they have available to them. It makes it more real and it drives action in a different way.
Switching gears back to something we touched on before is health equity as it pertains to health policy. How are you incorporating some of that into your work? I know we touched on it, that it was important, but are there some other activities you're focused on as well? Some actions that you'd like to see taken there?
The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation's mission is to find a cure and support for all people with cystic fibrosis. And we certainly recognize and know that health inequities have led to poor outcomes for many people in the CF community, particularly communities of color. So we can't accomplish our mission to find a cure for all unless we prioritize equity. So we really work to develop and improve the policies that the foundation supports so we can dismantle some of the barriers that prevent people with CF from reaching these optimal health outcomes and ultimately a cure that we're working for. A core principle of ours and a deep focus of the policy agenda of the foundation is to ensure adequate, affordable, and available healthcare coverage for everybody. And we also work with policymakers to reduce barriers to health equity, such as reducing barriers to enrollment in clinical trials, right? We need to make sure that the research we're funding and the drugs that we're developing are effective for everyone. And in order for us to know if they're effective for everyone, we need a broad, diverse population participating in clinical research to ensure that it works for them. So another really important focus of the foundation's work around equitable healthcare is addressing disparities in newborn screening. So nearly everyone with cystic fibrosis is typically diagnosed through newborn screening, that heel prick that a baby gets in the first day or two of life that goes through a panel of tests. And cystic fibrosis is one of the diseases that is screened for in newborn screening. And as a result, we've seen a lot more early diagnosis of cystic fibrosis, which is important because then the baby gets right into that highly specialized care that improves health outcomes. But unfortunately, we know that newborn screening panels are not as comprehensive as they need to be. And far too many of the panels miss more rare mutations of cystic fibrosis that more often occur in babies of color. So there's a very granular and urgent, timely way that the foundation is addressing equity in healthcare through our healthcare policies.
What actions can we all take to reduce the risk of antimicrobial resistance?
Do everything you can to prevent infection. Stay healthy, eat well, get vaccinated. Do the preventative things you can do because it matters.
I think it's really important to also advocate for the broader population to understand they have a flu or any viral cold or whatever, that's something that needs to be treated with antibiotics.
Basic things like washing your hands, wearing a mask when you're sick or in a clinical setting, and considering social distancing when appropriate, those have been hallmarks of cystic fibrosis for as long as most people can remember. We saw that during the COVID pandemic, that people with CF actually fared far better than we previously thought, in part due because we knew how to take infection prevention precautions.
If someone prescribes an antibiotic, ask if you need it. Make sure you understand that you need it and take it as it is recommended. If you're a mom like I'm a mom, when my kids were little, I asked the pediatrician if they were giving antibiotics, do we need them? And made sure we took them correctly. And if the pediatrician said, I'm not sure about this ear, I want you to come back in 2 days, we figured out a way to come back in 2 days.
The time to act is now so that we're prepared for the crisis of antibiotic resistance that's upon us.
You've been listening to Superbugs in You, a podcast series focused on true stories from scientists and patients around the world on the threat of antimicrobial resistance. This series is co-created by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and the Antimicrobial Resistance Fighter Coalition. The podcast is produced by Elise Holmes, Diane Flahart, and Natalie Vestin. For more news and information on antimicrobial resistance and stewardship, check out our websites, cidrap.umn.edu/ASP and antimicrobialresistancefighters.org. You can also find us on Twitter at cidrap_ASP and @AMResistance.